Okay, so we're back in marriage and parenting. Today, topic 12, parenting, discipline, and instruction. And so we've kind of laid a foundation thus far of parenting. And so we really actually started laying the foundation at first off with marriage, right? And then we've moved into specifics on parenting. But I wanted to review that this morning. And remind us of where we've been, and then with Casey last week talking about blended families and the whole thought behind that too. I thought it'd be good to just review today. So we started off with parenting, defining what is successful parenting. You guys remember what that is? What is successful parent? Successful biblical Christian parent. Being faithful, exactly. Being faithful, right? It's not results oriented, right? But it's being faithful. Being faithful. We talked about being faithful stewards of our parents. We talked about ensuring that we're submitted to God and His sovereignty and His ways. We talked about viewing our children as a gift and blessing from God, because I can tell you from experience, there will be times where we can be tempted not to think that, right? And so it is. We need to be making sure our mind is focused on that. We then looked at the purpose of parenting. That's the same as every purpose we have in life, to glorify God. Our purpose is not to have the most athletic, the most successful, from the world standpoint, children, but to glorify God, to be faithful stewards of what God has given us. We looked at our mission and goal of parenting, and that is the same as our mission and goal as believers, which is what? Make disciples, exactly, to make disciples. So we focus all of our parenting on glorifying God, His purpose, and His mission to be making disciples. That doesn't mean we don't teach our children how to read, right? And we'll talk about that today as well. But our focus is on teaching them about God and His Word. We talked about how to do that from Deuteronomy 6, speaking and living the gospel to our children. We talked about taking God's word in to our own hearts and minds, and that's the start of that, right? We need to be taking in ourselves. Then we talked about speaking continually about the Lord and His word through purpose and opportune events. And so we talked about having a purpose in our speaking with our kids, and as well as taking the opportunity as times arise to be talking about the Lord and His word with our children. We talked about displaying God's word in our own life, making sure that we are walking in the Spirit ourselves. We talked about teaching our children the entire counsel of the Word of God, not just focusing on those specific few, you know, fun stories that the kids love to hear, right? That they have stuffed animals for and stuff, but everything that God says. Then we talked about also highlighting the essential truths of the gospel to our children, not watering down the gospel, but giving the entire truth of the gospel to our children at age-appropriate ways for them to understand. Right? We talked about that. And we then looked at specific roles that God calls parents to fulfill. We talked about living out the one another's for our children not to only to experience but to see us do. We talked about being actively involved in a local body of believers. And so not just doing it on our own, but God has orchestrated and brought together His church so that we can help one another, and so we need to be involved in a body of believers. We talked about fulfilling our roles as husbands or wives, those things that God calls husbands and wives to. And we said that provides your children demonstration of true saving faith, establishes security in the home, and builds unity in your marriage, which is essential as you seek to raise your children. Unity in the marriage is critical. We talked about being a unified authority in your child's life, teaching them that they are to obey their parents. We talked about being an encourager, which was the opposite of provoking or exasperating our children. And we gave a long list of those things that wise, godly parents have said exasperate your children. I think the Spirit, through Paul, made that vague so that we can ourselves, as God gives us grace, as we're yielded to the Spirit, understand in our own lives how we may be exasperating our children. And then we talked about being a nurturer of our children, growing them, working to grow them and mature them, bring them to maturity. And so we talked about all of those things. So today we want to talk about specifically with being a nurturer. We talked about instruction and discipline. But we want to focus in on that today because there's a great deal of misunderstanding in our culture and within the church about discipline, particularly. Okay. So remember that we've talked about the world's approach to parenting. It's child-centered, focusing on behavior, results-oriented parenting. It becomes very easy, I think, for us to be focused on that, to be swayed from a biblical view of parenting because we just want results, right? There's times where we just want peace in our family. And sometimes children, as particularly as they grow older, don't give us that. And so we want peace. And so it's easy to be swayed to do things in a way that might not honor God because we're focused on results-oriented parenting. So we need to be very careful with that. We want to be very careful to keep him as first place in our lives. We don't want those desires for results to replace an eternal perspective for the soul and heart of our child. They can be as compliant on the outside that makes peace in the family, but if they're not compliant in their heart, they've missed the point. And so if they're not submitted to God in their heart, they've missed the point. So this whole section here essentially talks about that. As parents, we can also become focused on the intellectual development for our children. Has anybody, when the child was still inside mama, played music for the child? Anybody do that? No? Some people do that, right? Early childhood development specialists tell us that helps the child develop. In fact, there's a commercial out recently, if you've seen it on television, that talk about it contrasts reading and being involved with your child to having someone be on their phone and not involved with their child. And it talks about, I think it even says child, like there's a subtitle, child delinquent, that for the person with the mom on the phone, and these other kids turn out great, right? And so even the world is focused on an intellectually advantaged child by doing certain things, right? Having your child grow up to be able to think well in and of itself is not bad, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But what's our focus there? We want them to be able to think well about God and His Word, right? And so when we're focused on having our child read at age 2, right, a little early, right? The goal here is that we want our children to be able to read God's Word, right? Not that they can be the first in their class at school, in their preschool, and read the words on the page, right? So we want to be focusing on that. And we want our discipline, our instruction and discipline to be focused on, again, on making disciples. And so we need to be very careful that we're not swayed by the word. So I thought it would be interesting to look at some examples in Scripture of negative parenting styles. And so the Scriptures give us not just principles and precepts, but examples as well. And so here's some negative parenting styles, that we don't want to emulate, right? And there's reason why they're negative. So we don't want to emulate those. So I thought it would be interesting to look through this. So I think I have four examples, three examples and one principle. But the first one is the permissive parent. And for this one, we look to Eli the priest in 1 Samuel, in the book of 1 Samuel. And I have those passages in the notes here, but you're welcome to turn over there if you like. But Eli's sons, the Scriptures don't portray something very positive about his sons. They were worthless men, as 1 Samuel 2:12 tells us, and they did not know the Lord. So they did not have a saving relationship with the Lord, and they were worthless men. Worthless men. That's a strong phrase, don't you think, that God would use for someone. But they were worthless. So Eli's sons, they were priests. Eli was a priest, so his sons were priests. They took by force the best sacrificial meat before it was offered to the Lord. Essentially, they stole from the people. They were stealing from the people that ultimately they stole from God because they stole the sacrifice before it was offered. And they didn't take only what was given to them as priests. Deuteronomy 18:3 actually tells priests what they're able to take. That's their support from the sacrifice. But they did not do that. They actually stole from the people and ultimately from the Lord. In addition, they sexually exploited the women at the tabernacle where the Israelites came to worship. And in 1 Samuel 2:12, it tells us that. They were worthless men. So Eli knew this, actually. This wasn't a surprise for him. And he told his sons that they should not do this, these things, but he took no action to actually stop them from continuing in their evil behavior. And if you look at 23 to 25, it says, he said to them, Eli said to them, "Why do you do such things? The evil things that I hear from all these people. No, my sons, for the report is not good, which I hear the Lord's people circulating. If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death." They would not listen to the voice of their father. So all Eli did was tell them something. He actually didn't take action to correct the situation. And actually, I think the corrective action would have been to have his children put to death for the things they were doing. But he honored his children over the Lord. He honored his children over the Lord. In fact, that's what it says. A prophet came to Eli and was talking to him and told him what the Lord said to him. He said, "Why do you kick at my sacrifice and at my offering, which I have commanded in my dwelling, and honor your sons above me?" Okay? He told them something, but didn't follow up with action. That's a permissive parent. Permissive parent. Some of the characteristics of permissive parenting. Permissive parents equate firmness and discipline with meanness. Firmness and discipline with meanness. Now, firmness and discipline should be done in a way that honors God, and we'll talk about that. Right? But when we say being firm and disciplining our children, when we equate that with being mean, then we shy away from being involved in the discipline of our children. Therefore, we don't like the idea of discipline. A permissive parent gives few boundaries and inconsistently enforces the ones they give. They say, but don't enforce. They give verbal reprimands or threats, but take little action to correct the sinful behavior. If you do that one more time, I'll do this. And that one more time happens. If you do that again, right, they keep saying over and over. And finally, they succumb to the manipulation and whims of the child. Permissive parenting is ultimately child-centric. It's really a question for us is, do you follow up your words with actions? Do you follow up your words with actions? The next one is the uninvolved parent. The uninvolved parent. And for an example of this one, we can go to David. He was uninvolved and permissive. So David had lots of wives and lots of children. At least 19 sons and daughters as well. We know he at least had Tamar. And so most likely he had other daughters as well. So lots of kids. He spent lots of time away in battle and in ruling the kingdom. He's a busy person. Right? He was busy. Is anybody here busy? We're all busy, right? But that doesn't mean we have to not be involved in the lives of our children and in disciplining our children and instructing our children. However, the biblical accounts indicate he was not involved with respect to discipline and instruction of his children. So for that, we can look at the account of the rape of Tamar. And ultimately, David refused to be... If you remember this account... Tamar was Absalom's sister, I believe, and one of David's sons, Tamar's stepbrother, Amnon, lusted for her and ultimately raped her. And then some things ensued afterwards. So this occurred, and David actually knew this happened, but refused to become involved in justice for his daughter Tamar after she was raped by her brother Amnon. He actually knew this occurred, but didn't do anything about it. He wasn't involved in the lives of his children. Now it said that that Absalom, her brother, said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? But now keep silent, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this matter to heart." So Tamar remained and was desolate in her brother Absalom's house. Now when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. So David heard about this, but he didn't do anything about it. But Absalom did not speak to Amnon, either good or bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. So David knew this happened, but didn't do anything about it. He just wasn't involved with his kids. Absalom actually spent 2 years hating and plotting vengeance against his brother. And there's an indication that David knew that as well. But he didn't do anything about that either. In fact, it looked like David was concerned about Absalom killing Amnon. Again, but he did nothing about it. And eventually Absalom plotted and through deception killed his brother. He murdered his brother. And so you can see that from, if you read the account in chapter 13 of 2 Samuel, you can see that as well. So after he killed his brother Absalom, he fled to Geshur for 3 years. Geshur is where his grandfather was. His grandfather was the king of the city there. And so that it was to the east of the Sea of Galilee, up in that area. And so he fled to his grandfather for 3 years. And so David just neglected this relationship. He fled. Apparently, David was actually grateful that Absalom dealt with Amnon, which is strange since Absalom actually murdered his stepbrother. He actually murdered his stepbrother. But David was grateful because he didn't have to be involved in it. So someone else took care of the problem, a problem in an evil way, and David was okay with it. Eventually, David allowed Absalom to return to Jerusalem. But after Absalom returned, the account says that he didn't see the king's face for that entire 2 years. So he was living in Jerusalem with David in the same city, but David still didn't interact with him for 2 years. Right? David was uninvolved with his children. Uninvolved with his children. Ultimately, we see in 2 Samuel 15 that Absalom, his uninvolvement with his son ultimately resulted in Absalom attempting to steal the kingdom from him, right, through deception. We see that in 2 Samuel 15 where that happened, through subterfuge. And so this is, David was not involved in the lives of his children. Another example of David's uninvolvement is when he was old and his son, Abinadab, attempted to make himself king, David refused to discipline him. David refused to discipline him. And we see that in 1 Kings 1, it says, his father, that is David, had never crossed him at any time by asking, "What have you done?" David just refused to be involved in the lives of his children. Refused to be involved in the lives of his children. So some characteristics of uninvolved parenting, they have little or no involvement with their children. The children are doing what they want to do. Has few expectations put on the children. We expect that you will follow our rules, and we expect that you will follow what the Lord tells you to do, right, while you're in our home. That's what the expectation is. They have no meaningful communication with their children. We saw that with David, right? There was over five years went by, and he didn't even talk to his son regarding these things. And they place other activities above involvement with their children. What might those activities be? Work? Hobbies? You know parents who are really into their hobbies? All kinds of things. Maybe even ministry. We can place serving the Lord above our children. The question is, are you involved in the lives of your children? Now, some of us have small ones, right? So it's like babies. So it's tough not to be involved. Otherwise, you know, they need you involved. Otherwise, they can't survive. But as your children grow, are you involved in the lives of your children? Are you involved in the lives of your children? The next example, which really I couldn't find a specific example. Maybe you have one. But overprotective parents. I found examples of parents who were not overprotective, but I couldn't find examples of parents who were overprotective. So the overprotective parent is full of fear and insecurity and therefore attempts to control circumstances over which truly only God has control. That's the goal. Right? They're afraid, they're anxious, and therefore they try to control circumstances to protect their child. Protect them from physical harm, emotional harm, spiritual harm. They simply try to protect their children, overprotect them, never allowing them to experience difficulty in life, to grow from those difficulties. Okay, so they're overprotective. What might be some examples of this? What might be some examples of this? Of an overprotective parent? Maybe they never allow their child to play with other kids when they're little, or to be involved in sports because they're afraid they're going to get hurt.
Spend the night in the open house.
Yeah, they're afraid of having their child spend the night at another person's house. Obviously, you do wise things there, right? You know the parents; they're going to go stay at, right? You interact with them and everything, but we allow some freedom in those. What else might it be? So they don't hang out with other Christian children?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was actually the one I was going to think of. You don't allow your children to attend youth group even, right? Or to be involved with other children because you're afraid of, you know, a negative influence that other kids might have on your children. And there's all kinds of different ways this can be manifested, right? But what we're saying here is that we need to make sure we're not overprotected. Okay? Essentially, this kind of parenting has placed fear as a master in their life. Right? Fear and anxiety has become a master in their life. They do not trust God, that He is sovereign and able to work things out, to be in control of situations over which we have no control. We simply don't trust God. Okay. Now, trusting God does not remove us from being wise, right? We don't allow our children to play in the middle of a busy street, right? That's ridiculous. Yeah, why? Why not? When our kids were little, we let them play in the street. But we were there. We actually put signs up in the middle of the street that said, slow down, there's children at play. And we had lots of kids in the middle of the street. But we did it in a wise way, right? We didn't prevent them from playing because they were maybe going to be in danger. Okay. Some examples of parents who allowed their children freedom by trusting God are Elkanah and Hannah. With Samuel. What did they do with Samuel? Dropped him off at the temple, right? Well, they trusted God to care for their child. Now, I don't know that I would advocate dropping your child off at the church, wanting someone else to raise them at age 4 or 5, right? But we do see an example here of parents who were trusting God to care for their child. Okay. How about Jesse with David? What did David do? So at early teens, When Samuel came to anoint the new king, where was David? Out in the fields, shepherding the sheep. Right? Early teens doing that. Right? Killing lions and bears and all the other things that are out there. Right? I don't know that we would allow our children to do that today, right? But there's an example. I don't know that we want to do that. Right? I don't want my kids fighting coyotes out in the desert. But I think there's an example here of trusting God to care for your child. Right? I'm guessing Jesse did some things as David was growing up that prepared him to be able to do that. Right? But we see ultimately at an early age he was doing things that today adults would do. How about Mary and Joseph with Jesus? The account in Luke 2 there that I have down is when they had gone up to Jerusalem for the feast, and it took them some time before they left Jerusalem where they didn't know where Jesus was at. Right? Do you think they gave him some freedom to hang out with other people, with relatives as they were traveling? Right? Yeah. Right? They trusted God to care for their child. Now, they didn't just leave him. Now, when they found out he wasn't with them, right, they went looking for him, and they were worried about him. Right? But they gave him some appropriate boundaries to be able to exercise some freedom. And that's kind of what we're talking about here, right? Not being overprotective, but providing freedom for our children to do things at age appropriate as God gives us grace and wisdom. Some characteristics of overprotective children are they place age-inappropriate limitations on activities and circumstances to protect their child from imagined harm, or maybe real harm even. Right? Maybe physical, emotional, or spiritual harm. They place age-inappropriate boundaries on their kids. They arrange their family activities to ensure their child is safe. What might this be? They don't allow their children to go to a youth group. They don't allow their children to be involved with other people. They always have to do things as a unit, as opposed to allowing their children freedom to do things. Every night is family night. Yeah. How about they're constantly communicating with their child about the dangers of the world? The dangers of the world. We were, Rebecca and I were out front recently, and the neighbor kids around the block from us came riding by on their bicycles. And I don't know, I guess the ages were, they're old enough to go without training wheels.
Like 4 and 8.
4 and 8, and they come by. And Rebecca and I were like, oh, remember when our boys used to do that, and how they really wanted to go around the block on their bike, and eventually we let them go to the corner. Right, and then eventually we let them go around the block, and you know it was just reminiscent of ourselves giving our kids freedoms to be able to do some things. Right, but I might not have wanted, you know, an overprotective parent would have said no, right? Some evil person could attack you on the other side of the block. Well, some evil person could attack you anywhere, but we provide age-appropriate, bounded freedoms to our children. And finally, they fail to give the child the freedom to make mistakes and therefore grow in wisdom, right? They're always doing things for their kids. Always doing things for the children. Because they don't want their children to become injured in some way.
This is different. It varies from different
people, right? You bet, yeah.
Like for us, we moved into a home that we had lots of free wood and free old nails in the wood.
Yep.
Black widows. And our kids made boards and did all the kinds of stuff. But then I had other people tell me, oh my goodness, the Christy nails. Yeah. And so, like to them, that would not be wise for them to make
right.
their kids
yeah.
do
and,
that.
Yeah, you're right.
It I think
in this area, right, first of all, we don't want to judge other parents, right? That's not, we don't want to do that. But we also, for ourselves, as God gives us grace, we want to at least keep mindful of being overprotective. Understanding that it is God who is sovereign, right? But we also don't want our three-year-olds to play on the roof by themselves, right? Now, when they're in their early teens and they want to jump off the roof onto the trampoline, well, okay, we let them do that. And if they break a leg, well, we have insurance. Okay? The next negative is the authoritarian parent. The authoritarian parent. And for an example of this, you can go to King Saul. King Saul. He was angry, threatening, and vindictive. And so look at 1 Samuel 20 there. Jonathan and David were friends. Jonathan was essentially asking his father, what does David deserve? What has he done that he deserves this treatment that you're giving him? And Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." Son of a perverse and rebellious woman. And he goes on and on, right? Eventually he throws a sword or a spear at Jonathan, right? He's so angry, he throws a spear at him, right? This is this parenting style. Totally authoritarian, right? Rules with an iron fist. That kind of thought. And so some of these characteristics. Rules the children with an iron fist. Is overly strict and uses anger, yelling, threats, and harsh discipline to maintain control. And this is discipline that is outside of disproportional to the offense. Disproportional to the offense. This kind of parent is orders and rules oriented with little or no explanation. Do what I say because I said to do. Is focused on behavior manipulation and not heart level change. This kind of parent. All they want is a kid to do what they're told to do. They're not concerned about the heart of the child. So there are some negative parenting styles. Some negative parenting styles. Any questions or comments there before we move on? Okay. So as opposed to these, the permissive, uninvolved, overprotective, or authoritarian parent, those kind of parents provoke their children to anger. They exasperate their children. We've talked about that 2 weeks ago, right? As opposed to that, godly parents are to be the nurturer of their children. They're to bring their children up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And the responsibility for this, as Ephesians 6:4 tells us, is the father in the household. It's the father. Ephesians 6:4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Now, it's the father's responsibility, but it's the mother's role to assist the father in this responsibility. Right? We've already talked about being a unified team in coming to bring instruction and discipline in the raising of our children. It's the mother's role to assist the father because that's her designed role, right? To be the father's help, her husband's help. Bring them up here in Ephesians 6:4. This is kind of a review, but it means to provide adequate nourishment, to bring to maturity, to nurture. It's to be a lifestyle of habitual practice for the parent. It's a command. What's that mean? It's a command. It's not an option. If I'm not striving to do this, what am I doing? Sin. It is sin. Am I going to be perfect at this? No. But I want to strive, just like Paul says about love to Thessalonians, to excel still more. Right? I want to keep striving in this area. Discipline in Ephesians 6:4 means to provide instruction with the intent of forming proper habits of behavior, of providing guidance for responsible living, rearing and guiding a child towards maturity. It's a broad term, It signifies whatever parents do to train, correct, cultivate, educate children in order to help them develop and mature as they ought. It includes the idea of correction for wrongdoing. Okay? But when we think of discipline, what do we think of? Punishment. We think of punishment. If you're like me, when you think of discipline, you look back and you see your dad pulling the sword of his belt off. Right? That's what you envision. That's not what we're talking about here. It's included there, we'll talk about that in a second. But discipline is everything we do to correct the behavior of a child, to bring them to where they understand that what is sin and what is not sin. Yeah. Right. Right, but it doesn't necessarily mean punishment. Right? It may mean doing 100 push-ups. Right? But what it means is instruction, right? Repetitive influence, all of those things that we're going to talk about is discipline. When we think of discipline, we need to take out of our minds the idea of the paddle, right? Or the belt, or the hand. Those are not what we're talking about per se with discipline. Instruction means to put in the mind and applies teaching the Lord's ways through His Word. It's a word of encouragement or reproof which leads to correct behavior. And so all of this comes together, instruction and discipline, in the raising of our children. In the discipline, instruction of the Lord describes the focus of the command. It's according to the Lord's ways, His Word, and by the power of the Spirit, through the power of the Spirit. So as we are disciplining and instructing our children, we want to be ourselves walking in the Spirit. Because it's very easy in the moment to discipline and instruct in the flesh. Right? So we want to ensure we're walking in the Spirit. So the question is then, punishment or discipline? Is that what we're after? Punishment or discipline? So there's really a lot of misunderstanding about this, and so we want to make sure we understand it. Punishment is not the same as discipline, but as we just said, punishment is a part of discipline. Punishment is a part of discipline. More specifically, punishment is the negative consequence imposed by the parents when deemed necessary to discipline the child, to show them the wrongness of what they've done. Show them the wrongness of what they've done. Consequently, there may be discipline that does not involve punishment, just like we talked about. A word of encouragement. Right? An instruction of, this is wrong because this is what God says. Conversations. Helping the child to do the right thing. Coming alongside them and helping them to do the right thing. Right? All of these things can be our part of discipline, but also includes removal of privileges, right? Timeouts, and physical discipline as well. We see this distinction particularly when we look at Hebrews 12, where it says, the author explains that God disciplines those that are His. God disciplines His children. So we look at Hebrews 12 there, starting verse 4. You have not resisted the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by Him. For those whom the Lord loves, He disciplines, and He scourges every son whom He receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not then rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but He disciplines, that is, God disciplines us, for our good, so that we may share His holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet, to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruits fruit of righteousness. So the word here for discipline is the same word used in Ephesians 6:4 denoting training. It's the same word. Reprove in verse 5 means to bring to light, to reveal hidden things, to rebuke someone in such a way that they are compelled to see and to admit the error of their ways. To expose someone's sin in order to bring correction. Okay, that's reproof. Now, scourge is interesting in that it means a literal or figurative flogging. It actually comes from the root word for the whip. Okay. Now, I do not advocate a whip at all, so don't take that. But it's the word used for when Jesus was flogged at his crucifixion. Regardless of the use, either figuratively or literally, it is negative and as such can safely be called a means of punishment. There is punishment involved. So we see in these verses that there's a distinction between discipline and punishment, and that punishment is a means of discipline. That's important to know because not all situations call for the same type of discipline. Not every situation calls for physical discipline. Or the rod, as Proverbs tells us. And we have a clear guideline for when and why to use, when it would be wise to use physical discipline in Proverbs. Now, what kind of literature is Proverbs? It's wisdom literature. So what it says is, when it tells us something, that is a wise thing. A general truism. Right? Are they commands? Well, it could be restating a command from somewhere else where it is a command. But wisdom literature is a wise saying. It's a truism. It's not a command or a promise that we hang our hat on. Okay? So what it's saying here in Proverbs 22:15 is this is wise. This is a general truism. It is a wise thing. Proverbs 22:15 says, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. That's true. Right? That's not untrue. We know that. Okay, we'll explain that in a second, but we know that that's true. It says, the rod of discipline will remove it from him. The rod of discipline will remove it from him. So this is a wise saying. A wise saying. Not a command. That's very important. Because there are some people or some books you read, some sermons you listen to that will say if you do not discipline your child physically, you are sinning. That is not true. Nowhere in the Bible does it command you to physically discipline your child. It's a wise thing according to this verse, but there's no command that says that. Very important for us to understand. Very important. So what is physical discipline used for? According to this verse, it's used to remove foolishness from the heart of a child. Foolishness from the heart of the child. When we understand foolishness, we understand that foolishness and childishness are not the same thing. Childishness is not the same thing as foolishness. So when your child spills their grape juice on the carpet, on your white carpet, right? That's your fault because you didn't have a sippy cup. What, Brian? It's your fault for having a white carpet. And not having a lid on your sippy cup. That's simply childishness. When they break a precious heirloom that you had low in the house, right? And they're learning to walk, that is not foolishness, necessarily. When they board out something embarrassing or in a grocery store, that's not foolishness, childishness. When they wet the bed. When they're learning to potty train, they wet the bed. That is foolishness. That is childishness. When they draw on the wall, when you're teaching them to draw and you give them crayons, right? You turn your back and they draw on the wall. Something you've never told them not to do. Look, mommy, at my horsey. That is not foolishness. That's childishness. When your child cuts their own hair, when they're pretending to be Rocky, and they cut their own hair, this happened to us, that's childishness. It's not foolishness. We find here that punishment is for the purpose of removing foolishness from our children. Punishment, physical punishment, is reserved for foolishness. But we need to understand what that is, because in our mind, foolishness is doing a stupid thing. That's what we think foolishness is. From an adult's perspective, from a cultural perspective, that's what we think. That's not what foolishness is. Foolishness is rebellion. Is rebellion. Proverbs describes foolishness as the one who said does not fear God. It says in Psalm 14:1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Foolishness is rebellion. Foolishness is rebellion. This is when the child is not under the authority of God and therefore his parents, his or her parents. He's living under his own authority and he's driven by his own wants and passions, as Tripp said. It is rebellion. Rebellion against authority. Ultimately God's authority, but who has God placed over the children? Us, right, as parents. Us as parents. And actually, for a parent to not discipline these behaviors, foolishness, is actually one of the least loving things we can do. We say, well, it's not loving to do this. It's actually one of the least loving things we can do to not discipline. Proverbs 13:24 again, wisdom literature. He who withholds his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. If we love our children, we want them to not be foolish, to not be rebellious. That's what we want. The question then can be asked, what constitutes biblical punishment? If we follow Proverbs word for word, literal, we'd be using a rod. A rod. What comes to my mind is a piece of rebar, right? A stick. The apple sapling, right? Like we said, many parents believe that failing to use corporal punishment is a sin, and that's just not true. It's unwise. It's unwise. Question that then can be asked is, when should I punish? When should I punish? When should physical discipline be necessary? And ultimately, we can say that when a child displays foolish rebellion is when physical discipline is called for. Not childishness, not growing to maturity and just failing to be mature, but when rebellion is present, that is when physical discipline can be called for. What do we use for physical discipline? That's up to you. There's many folks who say, don't use a hand, because they you spank with one hand and then you reach in love with the same hand. They say that is confusing to the child. As God gives you grace, that would be up to you to decide. Principles on how to do this. And it's very important that we are understand those principles. For proper administration of physical discipline, we want to understand that who we look to is how God deals with us. God is our Father dealing with us. And our own walk with God. First thing is we want to ensure that you have communicated clearly what the expectation is for your child, because that's the same thing God does for us in His Word, right? He has communicated what His expectation is. He has communicated what the expectation is. We want to ensure that we are walking in the Spirit. We don't want to be angry. We don't want to be bitter, anxious, impatient. None of those things want to be present. If not, you need to take time to pray, confess, and repent from those sins before administering punishment, before administering discipline. I think you also want to gather appropriate information as best you can. There's times where you discipline and the situation was not what you thought it was. We want to make sure we understand the situation. Be prayerful for yourself, for your child, and for God's glory. Communicate clearly why your child is being punished. They're being punished because of rebellion. Love your child throughout the process, which is a reflection of how God deals with us. Love your child. Any questions or comments? Yes.
As a believer, discipline, godly discipline, can you be prepared to set aside that time, especially that for younger children?
Yeah.
If it's involving 3 children, 4 children, that could take up to like 45 minutes sometimes. And doing it and explaining to them that they're not sinning against me, or they didn't sin against their sister, or whoever they sinned, they sinned against God. I'm not perfect at this, obviously, but I think that's something that we need to try to focus on.
Yeah.
You're not sinning against me.
Right.
You're sinning against God.
Right. Yeah, we want them to understand that their sin is ultimately against God. That's right. And like you said, Spence, it takes time.
Right.
It takes time. Right. It could... the things that you had planned may not occur, right, because it takes time.
Okay. I'd also add that it's humbling, because you can't just say, well, I'm going to be a really godly Christian, and decouple that from your own relationship with God, because if you are not spiritually vigilant, you're not going to see that. You're not going to see that my plans are out the window now, but that's okay, because God's plans are being priorities.
Yeah.
And that whole wisdom and everything, it's like, if you're walking in the flesh and not in the Spirit, you're going to blow that. Hmm. And so it's this humbling realization that my spiritual vigilance is not where I want it to be, and just packing the personal sanctification as a part of it.
Right. Right. You need to be walking in the Spirit yourself. That's right. Excellent. So do we have to use physical discipline? No. Is it okay to use physical discipline? According to God's principles, yes. Yes.
But if I keep doing that, I don't know if I'm going to have another way I can say this, but so
I think that should be part of the talking out of why is it logical God.
Yeah, I think you just need to be consistent in that. I think you're saying the right things to her. You just need to be consistent and follow that up with action, as we talked about. That's a good point. Yes.
For any, I know there's a lot of teenagers right now. One thing that we see is that one thing that we honor our parents. So and try to explain some of the things in our relationship with her parents who are still alive and now help, you know, even in times as they're older, some of the things in our relationship with them and how we continue to grow that and try to use it, you know, I do think it's an example generational thing too. And I know Zips of course talked about in 6:1 3:2.
We don't want to take the discipline of the discipline instruction of our children out of the context of our relationship with other people, with our own parents, as parents to our parents, and our behavior and attitudes towards them. Our children learn those things, right? If we're disrespecting our parents, our children see that. Right? So we need to be. That goes back to walking in the Spirit, as we were saying earlier. Excellent. Yes. And exactly, there is grace and mercy involved in discipline, which is difficult sometimes. But when they don't get what they deserve, that's mercy. That's mercy. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. We're going to pick this up next week then, here, and we'll finish out this lesson, and I'll add some more stuff in on a different topic then next week as well.